This morning, I want to talk in my lesson about the temple of God. The passage that Jeff just read for you, of course, is from the Apostle Peter talking about the temple of God today, which is, of course, the new covenant. It's the church. It's the kingdom of Christ. It's the saved. It's Christians. We are the temple of God. I want to go back in Bible history and talk about what the temple was, the Old Testament temple, what it represented, why it was built, what it was supposed to do, and then talk about that as the model for us today as the temple of God, as God's people. What are we supposed to do if we are the temple of God? One of the problems that, that's not the right term, God doesn't have problems. One of the challenges or one of the things God's got to deal with, if you want to put it that way, God can deal with anything. But what God has to do is he's an invisible God. The Bible says he's invisible. Obviously he's invisible, or you'd see him. He's invisible. He's in the heavens. We don't walk up and just see him visibly every day. So how does he make his presence known? How does this great invisible God make his presence known? How are we supposed to know that he's really there? And there are a number of ways that he can do that and has done it. Of course, there have been miraculous events in Bible history, but those didn't happen every day back then, and they're not happening now. But one of the ways that God did it was through the temple. He put the temple down there so that people could find God in some visible sense. They could go somewhere to meet God. And that's what Solomon did in 1 Kings chapter 6. Solomon built the temple and finished it. And it talks about all the buildings and the wood and the kind of wood he used and everything. Verse 21, overlaid the inside of the temple with pure gold. Imagine that, what that would have looked like. Stretched gold chains across the front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid it with gold. The whole temple he overlaid with gold until he had finished all the temple. Overlaid with gold the entire altar that was by the inner sanctuary. Solomon had like a giant blank check that he could write. I mean, he had an unlimited budget, all right, to pay whatever it cost to make that temple look as beautiful and as expensive as it possibly could. And God was glorified by that. That temple was beautiful, covered with gold. 1 Kings 7, verse 10 says the foundation was costly stones, large stones, some 10 cubits, some 8 cubits, costly stones, hewn to size, and cedar wood. Cedar wood had to be imported from Lebanon. Didn't grow in the backyard in Israel. Had to go get it. It was expensive. The temple was an expensive, beautiful project that was designed to glorify God. And it did. God was glorified. God approved of what Solomon did. Came down from heaven and said so. And so when that happened, 1 Kings chapter 8, it came to pass when the priests came out of the holy place that the cloud filled the house of the Lord. This is Solomon dedicating the temple. Priests could not continue ministering because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. God came down from heaven and made his presence known at that temple to tell everybody, this is my house, I am present here, I approve of this, and this thing here is glorifying me. This is where I'm going to be. Now, I get it, and Solomon got it. God, you can't put God in a building and shut the door and say, okay, he's in there, he's not out here. God is everywhere. He's bigger than the universe. We all get that, and Solomon got it too. Solomon spoke, the Lord said he would dwell in a dark cloud. I have surely built you an exalted house and a place for you to dwell in forever. But then Solomon goes on to comment on this temple and its limitations. He says, but will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain you. He's bigger than the universe. How do you put him in a building? Well, you can't. How much less this temple which I have built? Yet regard the prayer of your servant and his supplication, O Lord my God, and listen to the cry and the prayer which your servant is praying before you today, that your eyes may be opened toward this temple, night and day, toward the place of which you said, my name shall be there, that you may hear the prayer which your servant makes towards this place. The temple, Solomon knew that the building itself couldn't contain God, that it was a representation. It was a focal point of worship. It was a place where people could come to find God in some direct personal way, more so than anywhere else, more so than just out under a tree or at their home. When they came to the temple, they were meeting God in some more direct way than they would anywhere else. If you want to find out about the one true God of the universe, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, you could go to Jerusalem and go to that temple and know there were people there who were glorifying God and who could tell you about the true God. And you could find out about God by going to that place because God was there. So he made his presence known through that temple in a big way, in a glorified way, with this beautiful building that represented his presence. Well, okay, as far as that goes, that's good. But you can imagine, if you know Old Testament history, you know where this is headed. There's some problems with that. And the problems aren't on God's end. The problems are always on man's end, right? That's where the problem is. It's always where it is. But we'll get to that. How does a God who wishes to remain invisible make his presence known on earth? Well, that temple that was built by God's own people, the people he had a covenant with, could also be approached by foreigners and strangers, those who he did not have a covenant with, outsiders. In 1 Kings 8:41, Solomon said, "Moreover, concerning a foreigner who is not of your people Israel, but has come from a far country, for your name's sake," okay, they're going to hear about this name of this great Jehovah God that Israel worships, and this beautiful temple that he's got, and this, the power of this God. And they're going to come to Jerusalem to hear about this. "For they will hear of your great name and your strong hand and your outstretched arm. When he comes and prays toward this temple here in heaven, your dwelling place, and do according to all for which the foreigner calls to you, that all peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your people Israel, and that they may know that this temple which I built is called by your name." The temple of God also had a purpose of spreading the knowledge of God, if you want to call it an evangelistic sense, I guess you could call it that. But it was going to help other people, outsiders, learn about the one true God. Because they're going to hear about God, they're going to want to find out more, and they're going to come to this temple to worship this God that they haven't known before. But now they're hearing about him. And the temple is going to be a way of reaching out to outsiders to learn about the true God, people who don't know him. The temple makes known the presence of God to those who don't know him. Well, all right. And this is kind of a side note, but that's not the only way God's presence is known. Of course, King David in the Psalms, Psalm 19, said, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge." You can learn about God. If you want to know that God exists, go outside at night and look up. And you'll see him. Well, not literally, but you'll see his handiwork. You'll see that there was a great God who created all of that. There must be somebody who made all of that. There's somebody behind that who's powerful and intelligent and mighty. The firmament shows his handiwork. It's like a giant painting. My grandmother was an artist. I inherited none of her talent in that ability or that area. But she painted beautiful paintings. Had no training. It was mostly just her own natural abilities. Sold paintings, too. Sold them. And if you look down in the corner of all of her paintings, you'll see a little signature at the corner with her name in it. And that's kind of what David's getting at here. That's if you look up in the sky, there's like a little signature in the corner that says, "God did this." Okay, that's his painting, and he signed it. That's how you know God exists, because he painted something and put a signature on it. And you know it exists. The paintings that my grandmother made didn't make themselves. They didn't just, the paint didn't explode and create something, and nobody made it. Somebody made it and they signed their name to it. Somebody made all of that and signed his name to it. Nature makes known the glory of God, but there are limits to how much nature can tell you. I can go out at night and look at nature, look at the sky, or even during the day and look at the trees and the sun and everything. And I can tell that there's a God, a powerful, intelligent God who made all of that. But I don't know what his will is for me. I can't tell by that. It doesn't tell me what I should do. It might impel me to worship him, but I don't necessarily know how to worship him. I might try, but I might not be doing it right, because I don't know. It doesn't reveal all the details about what he wants from me and how I should worship him. Those are not revealed by nature. But his existence and his power are revealed by nature. Another way that God reveals himself is through his people, through the way his people perform good works. In Matthew 5:16, Jesus said, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." People will glorify God if they see us, his people, doing the kind of good works that we should be doing. So God can make his presence known through the agency of his people when his people live the way they ought to, even though God remains invisible. Well, let's go back to that temple. And there's a little caption up there that may have been suggested by the words of God coming to Solomon in 1 Kings 6 and verse 11. The word of the Lord came to Solomon. Okay, he's building the temple. And the word of the Lord came to Solomon saying, "Concerning this temple which you are building, if," there's that pesky word "if" again. Keeps popping up everywhere in the Bible. And as R.D. says, it's the biggest little word in the Bible. It's just, well, let's keep reading. "If you walk in my statutes, execute my judgments, keep all my commandments, and walk in them, Then I will perform my word with you, which I spoke to your father David. And I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel. So Solomon built the temple and finished it. God put a condition on that temple, didn't he? He said, if you walk in my commandments, then I'll be with Israel. And I won't forsake my people. And I'll dwell in that temple and I'll stay with the people of Israel and I'll save you. If you keep my commandments. Well, we know how that turned out, don't we? My point here is this. God didn't just want a building. He didn't just want a nice-looking temple, a nice-looking building that people would say, wow, look at all that gold and look at that silver and look at the cedar and look at the stones. They're costly and they're expensive and they're beautiful. Yeah, that's nice. But that's not really what he wants. What he wants is behind all of that. What he wants is in the hearts of the people. What about the people that go to that temple and worship there? What does he really want? People who keep his commandments, people who serve him. That's what he really wants. Because without that, the stones and the gold and the cedar and all that stuff doesn't mean anything. What good is all that if the people going there don't worship him right? Don't care about his laws? Don't really have him in their hearts? Temple's not going to do much. Here's what Jeremiah said. And this is during the time when the Babylonians are coming and they're going to destroy that temple that Solomon built. In a short time, Jeremiah predicts that that temple is going to be torn down. It's going to be destroyed. And the people of Jeremiah's time in Jerusalem have a false sense of confidence. They think that building is going to save them. Solomon built this temple. It's the temple of Jehovah God. And Jeremiah says, do not trust in these lying words saying the temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord are these. Well, why not? Why can't we just trust in having this building that Solomon built, that God said he's put his name there? Why can't we trust that building? For if you thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if you do not oppress the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, oh, we got to stop doing all these bad things if we want God to save us. We can't just sit here and say, well, we've got the temple of God, so everything's good. It doesn't work that way. Because the temple of God by itself does nothing if God is not in the hearts of the people. If God is not in their hearts, he will also not be in their temple. What's going to happen? Verse 10, verse 9, Jeremiah 7. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, burn incense to Baal, and walk after other gods whom you do not know, and then come and stand before me in this house? Really? You're going to go out and do all of that? And then show up in the temple and say, praise Jehovah, praise God. You're not going to accept that kind of worship. That temple isn't going to save you because he's not in your hearts. He's not in your lifestyle. What's he going to do? Therefore, I will do to the house which is called by my name, in which you trust, and to this place which I gave to you and your fathers, as I've done to Shiloh, and I will cast you out of my sight. I'm going to destroy it, burn it down. Because that building doesn't mean anything if he's not in the hearts of the people who worship there. In our recent study of the book of Ezekiel that we just finished a few weeks ago, you will recall that there are several chapters in Ezekiel that progressively describe God's exit from the temple and from Jerusalem. Ezekiel is a prophet in captivity. Some of the people have already gone into Babylonian captivity, but some are still remaining. Jerusalem hasn't been destroyed yet. And so Ezekiel is seeing this vision of what's going to happen to Jerusalem very shortly. And to the remainder of those who have not yet gone into exile. And in Ezekiel chapter 8 and verse 3, the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven, and brought me in visions of God to Jerusalem, to the door of the north gate of the inner court, where the seat of the image of jealousy was. Talking about idols. They've got idols in Jerusalem. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there. Okay, the glory of God is in Jerusalem, just like Solomon said. But then what happens? He lifts up his eyes. He sees the idolatry. Verse 6, furthermore, he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they're doing? The great abominations that the house of Israel commits here to make me go far away from my sanctuary. I'm going to leave the sanctuary. I'm not going to stay here in this temple because look at the way the people are living. Look at the bad things they're doing. I'm not going to stay here and put up with it. And then you keep reading the book of Ezekiel, chapter 9. That was chapter 8. This is chapter 9. The glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub, from the sanctuary, where it had been, to the threshold of the temple. The glory of God is leaving the sanctuary and it's heading for the exit. Hadn't left all the way yet, but it's at the doorway. It's at the threshold. God's getting ready to leave, and he's heading for the exits. Chapter 10, glory of the Lord went up from the cherub, paused over the threshold. The house was filled with a cloud. The court was full of the brightness of the Lord's glory. He's still there, but he's heading for the exit. Verse 18, the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. The cherubim lifted their wings, mounted up from the earth in my sight. Chapter 11, the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood on the mountain, which is east side of the city. He's left the building, now he's leaving the city. God has left the temple and he's even leaving Jerusalem. You'll see in chapter 43 of Ezekiel that there's a new temple that Ezekiel talks about. A better temple, a temple that isn't defiled, a temple where God's glory will rest forever and isn't going to get up and leave. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But that's the transition, this contrast between the old temple in Jerusalem, where Ezekiel saw God get up and leave, with the new temple, the new covenant, the one where God's glory stays permanently. Because all the people that are in the kingdom of Christ are the ones who serve him. If you're not serving him, you're not in his kingdom. We'll talk about that in a minute, the new and better temple. But God leaves the temple when his people no longer act like his people. That's when God gets up and leaves. He doesn't stay in a temple that has people in it that aren't serving him. In fact, God would rather have no temple at all than to have a beautiful temple attended by unclean and impenitent worshipers, wouldn't he? How do I know that? Because that's exactly what he did in 586 BC. He said, I'd rather have that thing burned down than have a bunch of people there with a nice, beautiful temple who don't serve me. He'd rather have it burned down, have no temple at all, than have a bunch of people who don't care about him. And that's what happens in 586 BC. Babylonian captivity, destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, burn it down. I don't want it. Don't want that kind of temple. No temple at all. Well, where does that leave? After the Babylonian captivity ends, the remnant comes back from captivity, comes back to Jerusalem during the Persian Empire. They come back and they're given permission and power from the Persians to rebuild the temple. They finally get that project going and they finally finish. It takes them a while, but they build, lay the foundations. The priests begin restoring the worship, the Levites. They have the instruments and the songs and everything. And the people shout with a great shout. There's still a few of the elderly people who had seen the first temple, verse 12, Ezra chapter 3. They wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes, yet many shouted aloud for joy. Some of the old men who had seen Solomon's temple may have been a little disappointed that this second one they'd built wasn't anywhere near as big and beautiful as Solomon's. But nonetheless, the people are shouting because they've got the temple again. Now they can worship God like they should, like God wants to be worshiped. All right, well, that's good, I guess. But what does it mean? Herod the Great comes along in about 19 BC. You remember Herod the Great tried to kill baby Jesus. Dies around 4 BC, and then his son Archelaus takes over, and then so on. Herod the Great begins a project in about 19 BC of refurbishing and upgrading that little temple that the exiles had built in Jerusalem back in the 500s BC. Herod the Great wanted it to maybe to be as beautiful and as expensive and whatnot as Solomon had made, mostly to glorify himself. I don't think he cared about glorifying God very much, but he wanted people to think how great he was, so he made the temple much bigger and beautiful and expensive, and it had an effect. In fact, Herod's project, although he died long before it was completed just a few years before 70 AD when it was all torn down again. What a sad commentary on life that is. But in Mark 13, for example, as the apostles are coming into Jerusalem with Jesus, it says, as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here." It was an impressive project. Herod had succeeded, and those who succeeded him, Herod had successfully made the temple big and beautiful and with gold and everything, and made it look really nice again. And Jesus said, "No, it's all coming down. It's all going to be destroyed. Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone should be left upon another," Jesus said. "It should not be thrown down. It's all coming down." Well, all right. All right. And sure enough, in 70 AD, that's what happens. Luke 11:49 explains the reason why that second temple, even as it was refurbished and beautified and spruced up by old King Herod and his followers, Luke 11:49, Jesus explained why even that second temple had to be torn down. Therefore, the wisdom of God also said, I will send them prophets, talking about God's people, talking about Israel. We're not even talking about the foreigners and the heathens and the sinners. We're talking about God's people, who unfortunately were sinners, but supposed to be God's people. Therefore, the wisdom of God also said, I will send them prophets and apostles, and some of them they will kill and persecute. Of the blood of all the prophets, which was shed from the foundation of the world, may be required of this generation. From the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who perished between the altar and the temple, yes, I say to you, it shall be required of this generation. Jesus said that the Jewish people of his generation, of that day, were going to have to pay the price for all the terrible things that God's people, God's own people, had done. And it was all going to be coming down. The temple would be destroyed and Jerusalem would burn down. Why? Because God's people weren't acting like God's people. They rejected his word, they rejected his prophets, they rejected the Messiah, they rejected the apostles, and now God was going to turn his back on them and burn down the temple for the second time. All right, well, ultimately, and this is true all throughout Old Testament and New Testament history, the short break between 30 and 70 AD, you might say, but we'll talk about that in a second. But ultimately, God only has one temple. One of the sins of Jeroboam when the kingdom was divided in the days of David's grandson, Jeroboam, was that Jeroboam set up alternate places of worship. You remember that? And Dan and Bethel puts up golden calves so people don't have to go back to Jerusalem to the one true temple to worship. Too far to go back down there, folks. Just stay up here in the northern kingdom. Don't need to go to Jerusalem anymore. So he puts up alternate places of worship, contrary to God's will. There was one temple and one place of worship that people were supposed to go to. And that was the temple in Jerusalem. All throughout Old Testament history, starting with the tabernacle in the wilderness, and then with the temple in the time of Solomon, and then the temple gets destroyed, it gets rebuilt, but there's only one. The Jewish people, the nation of Israel, was never told to build more than one temple. Only one, the one in Jerusalem. That's where you go. One and only one. In the New Covenant, the apostles wrote that Christians are the temple of God. And when you understand that, you understand why the temple has to be destroyed, and the Jewish temple has to be destroyed in 70 AD, because God only has one. You can't have two temples of God operating at the same time. And the one in Jerusalem, the physical building in Jerusalem, was no longer serving him. People who worshiped there were not his people anymore. They'd abandoned him. They rejected the apostles and prophets, rejected Jesus as the Messiah. And so God rejected them and said, no, my temple is over here now. That's not my temple anymore. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 6, verse 16, what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. You Christians are the temple of God now. That's why you can't have idols, because you can't have idols in God's temple, and you're the temple. So you can't have idols in your life. That'd be like bringing idols into Solomon's temple. You can't do that. It's an abomination. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God and they shall be my people. It's a quote from Leviticus 26, where God said that he would live and dwell among the nation of Israel. But of course, that promise was, remember the conditions? Remember that word if that I kept bringing up? If they keep his laws, if they serve him, if they keep the covenant, if they don't go after the idols. God will have that one temple among his people, if they serve him. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 3:17, if anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy. Which temple you are? You are the temple of God. Don't defile yourself. Be holy. Stay away from the sinful things of this world. Keep your life clean. What happens if we are the temple of God? You know what happens when sin comes into our life? We do things we ought not to be doing. It's like spray painting graffiti on the stones of the temple. That's what it's like. We're the living stones in the temple of God. And if our lives don't reflect that, imagine going to Jerusalem in the first century, spray painting that temple in Jerusalem with some kind of stuff on the side of the wall. All that gold and so on, you sprayed over it. How ugly would that be? What do you think would happen to you if they caught you doing that? Wouldn't be pretty, would it? Why would we do that? But that's where the temple of God. I love that picture. Can you see that? Is it big enough to see? Some old fella out there, and I guess that's his cabin in the middle of the Ozarks, or the, I don't know where that is. I want you to imagine for a moment that our church puts up a building like that and puts a sign on it that says Temple of God. And that's, what impression would you get about the God that we serve if we put a sign like that on a building like that? What would you think about our God? Well, what kind of a God is he? It must not be much of one if that's what you think of him. You think that represents your God? Really? He's not much of a God if that's... But see, that's my point. That's my point. If your life looks like that, and you're claiming to be a temple of God, then he's not much of a God, is he? Or else you're not much of a temple, one or the other. How does our life reflect the presence of God in our lives? If it's all messed up and fallen down, spray painted and crummy. Not much of a temple, or else not much of a God. You see, every day, you and I, we are either building up the temple of God, or else we're tearing it down. We're either making it bigger and more beautiful, or else we're spray painting it and knocking down chips out of the wall and tearing down stones and making it look bad. That's why Peter says in 1 Peter 2 and verse 4 that we read just a moment ago, Jeff read for us, coming to him as a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. Jesus is that big cornerstone of the temple. And you also, verse 5, as living stones are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood. We are building up that house of God. We are the temple of God. Each one of us is like a stone in the temple. What's the temple look like? Looks like us. How do we reflect the presence of God? People look it up and say, do they look at us and say, yeah, those people are the people of God. And they reflect the glory of God. And surely God is among them because look at the way they live. Look at how they worship him. Look at how dedicated they are to serving him. Look at their lifestyle and the way they live, things they do and they don't do. Those people are God's people. Or they look at that building and say, look, it's fallen down. It's spray painted with graffiti and it's junky. And that's not much of a temple. What do people see when they look at the temple of God? They're looking at us because we represent God to the world. We are, if people are looking for God, they're looking at us. Can they find God when they look at us? What kind of a temple are you building? In Ezekiel 43, we find this new temple. Ezekiel saw God get up and leave the old temple. But then he sees in his vision, he sees a vision of a new temple. I heard him speaking to me from the temple. This is the new one, the visionary one. This one that he sees in a vision. It's not a physical place, but it's in a vision of this perfect temple. This one, the one that God really wants. This beautiful one. He said to me, son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever. No more shall the house of Israel defile my holy name. God was going to have this new visionary temple where his name wouldn't be defiled, where it wouldn't be a building that looks like that that's fallen down spiritually. Because in God's view, that picture on the right is what the temple in Jerusalem looked like in 586 B.C. It looked like a junk pile. And God didn't want to live in it. Who'd want to live in a place like that? God doesn't want to, and neither would I. God wants to live in a nice house, you see. We are that house of God. What does this house look like? Is it a pile of junk, or is it a nice house that God can be happy to live in? Where would you rather live? Here's the key points to remember, and then I'll wrap things up. The temple of God, both in the Old Testament and in the New, is where God can be found by those seeking him. People are looking for God. We have to be sure that we represent him so people can find him when they come to us. If people are looking for God, we should be the place to find him. The temple of God is where God is worshipped. In fact, it's the only place where God can be worshipped properly. In the Old Testament, the temple was the one place. They had the priesthood and the sacrifices and the orchestra and all that stuff where people of God could be worshipped according to the law of Moses. One and only one place. We are the temple of God. Outsiders, people who are not God's people, people who are not baptized believers in Christ or not walking in the light of his word, they can't worship, they can't glorify God. They can try, they can go through the motions, they can do things, but that's not the worship of God. The worship of God is in his temple, it's in his people. Temple is where God is worshipped by those who sincerely serve him daily in their lives. And it is the advertisement of God to the world who doesn't know him. we have to advertise God. Just as Solomon said that temple in Jerusalem was going to be an advertisement of God to foreigners and outsiders, that's what you and I are. We represent God to the rest of the world that doesn't know Him. How are we doing on that? When people look at us, do they see the beautiful temple of God and say, I want to be part of that. I want to join that. I want what they have. I want to serve the God that they serve. Or do they see a junk pile and say, who'd want to live in that? Hopefully they see us as the temple of God, and I hope we see ourselves that way too, because it puts a great responsibility on us, but also a great privilege. What a great privilege it was for Israel to have that beautiful temple. What a great privilege it is for us to be that temple today. Would you take a few moments with me in prayer, please?